We've been going over this, kind of cruising through it. We haven't been taking it necessarily verse by verse as we had been with some of the earlier books, and we've given you the reason why several times. Tonight we're going to continue on in our pace. We're going to cover several chapters. We'll be picking up here in chapter 17. We've been looking at the offerings that the children of Israel were to give, and some of the important aspects of how these atoning sacrifices were to take place on the Day of Atonement. That's where we left off. God had gone through and dealt with several different aspects of how He wanted the Israelites to be separate in terms of their diet, in terms of their hygiene, different things like that. And now he's continuing on with this, still dealing with these issues of separation, dealing with what it is that's going to make the Israelites unique and distinct from all the nations that are around them. Because all the pagan nations live life and deal with the issues of life in certain ways. And God is sending out a clear message to the children of Israel, and it's a message that comes to us as well, then, that this world as we see it, the world as we've always known it, is not the world that God had intended it to be. That things have gone terribly wrong. And so in order to illustrate how wrong things had gone, he's put into place all of these various laws that cause Israel to be separate, but they also illustrate God's righteousness and illustrate for us how completely other than this fallen world he is. So here in chapter 17, God is going to be dealing with issues that pertain to blood now. And I want to kind of read through this because this is some interesting stuff. Let's just begin here. I want to read the first four verses of chapter 17. It says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron, to his sons, and to all the children of Israel, and say to them, This is the thing which the Lord has commanded, saying, Whatever man of the house of Israel who kills an ox or lamb or goat in the camp, or who kills it outside the camp, and does not bring it to the door of the tabernacle of meeting to offer an offering to the Lord before the tabernacle of the Lord, the guilt of the bloodshed shall be imputed to that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off from among his people." God, in this particular chapter, is going to be identifying the significance of blood for the Israelites. Now, we talked about this earlier, that, you know, we look at all these different sacrifices, and you can kind of get grossed out, and you're thinking, oh, you know, why all the blood? Why all of this stuff? Well, God's going to be kind of revealing some aspects of this. Why all this blood, and what this is all about? Now, we've talked about it before, about how God was going to be using blood as an atonement for the sins of mankind. And so here again, we're seeing that significance illustrated by God in this. In the pagan cultures, even in the case of the early patriarchs, when an offering was going to take place, the cultures surrounding them, or the patriarchs, would just do an offering wherever they wanted to. When Abraham, you know, was moved by a specific event that was going on, remember, he would just do an offering to the Lord right there where he was, and he would offer that to him. But God is changing that now, and he's indicating to them that that's not the way things are going to work anymore. Now there's a specific centralized location for an offering. It's to be brought to the door of the tabernacle, and the tabernacle is now this dwelling place where God is going to meet with man, and so he wants the sacrifice coming there. And it illustrates again to us that while God's arms are wide open to all who want to come to him, it doesn't mean that man can just come to God any old way he chooses. Just like the Israelite wasn't to just do an offering any old place he felt like it anymore, God's saying, no, there are specific means and ways in which I want this done. And he's paving a way, he's pointing a way, that there's going to be one specific way that man will come to me, and it's through Jesus Christ. And so, again, he's illustrating his plan in this. We read verses 5 through 9. And he says, "To the end that the children of Israel may bring their sacrifices, which they offer in an open field, that they may bring them to the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, to the priest, and offer them as a peace offering to the Lord. And the priest shall sprinkle the blood on the altar of the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and burn the fat for a sweet aroma to the Lord. They shall no more offer their sacrifices to demons, after whom they have played the harlot. This shall be a statute forever for them throughout their generations. Also, you shall say to them, whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers who dwell among you who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and doesn't bring it to the door of the tabernacle of meeting to offer it to the Lord, that man shall be cut off from among the people." And so again, identifying the distinction and difference between them and the pagan cultures around them. This offering is very important. There's a distinct difference between the way they're to do this and where they're to do this than the pagan cultures around them. And even identifies there in verse 7, he points out what idol worship really is, the worship of demons. 1 Corinthians 10, 20, and 21 expound on this. Paul's talking about that when people are offering meat to idols, we know it means nothing, but in actuality, they are actually offering that to a demonic force that would be behind whatever idol is out there. Verses 10 through 12, he says, "Whatever man of the house of Israel or the strangers who dwell among you who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood, and I will cut him off from among the people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I've given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul. Therefore, I said to the children of Israel, no one among you shall eat blood, nor any stranger who dwells among you shall eat blood." Okay, so here again, unlike the pagan practices all around them, there's a strong prohibition here concerning how they're going to deal with blood, and especially in the consumption of blood, in the eating of blood. Now, you know, we kind of think, well, what's the big deal? Why? Why is this prohibition in here? Why would God have this like this? God was going to be using blood to make atonement for mankind's sins. And he explains the principle behind it. The life is in the blood. There's a life force in blood. However you want to interpret that, clearly God is making a connection between blood and the life of an individual. And that's why the life of the innocent animal is taken in place of the guilty. And so God is making this identification, and thereby he's placing blood in a position of something that needs to be respected and dealt with a level of respect. Just as a matter of principle, he's saying here, all animals butchered by Israel are going to be respected in the way that the blood is dealt with, because it's pointing towards the significant blood that's going to be shed by Jesus Christ. He's developing in them an attitude that is respectful and observant of blood. And that's what he's identifying for them. That's what he's getting across in that. The life of the flesh is in the blood. So that even for the Israelites, all through their history, they would, whether, you know, they're butchering an animal, unlike a lot of the pagan cultures around them, and even cultures to this day, when they would butcher an animal, they would drain all the blood out of it and only consume it after something like that had transpired. Whereas many pagan cultures would eat the flesh while the blood was still in it. And so God's saying that he's not allowing for this. And then verses 13 to 16, he says, "Whatever man of the children of Israelites or the strangers who dwell among you who hunts and catches any animal or bird that may be eaten, he shall pour out its blood and cover it with dust. For it is the life of all flesh. Its blood sustains its life. Therefore, I said to the children of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of all flesh is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. And every person who eats what died naturally or what is torn by the beasts, whether he's a native of your country or a stranger, he shall both wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening, and then he'll be clean. But if he doesn't wash them or bathe his body, then he shall bear his guilt." In other words, he's bear the guilt of this blood. God's getting this across, and we don't want to minimize that. And I guess the reason this is important too, especially for us as New Testament believers, is that there is such a temptation to minimize the importance of blood. When it comes to Christianity, there's huge movements abroad that try to minimize the importance of blood. We look at Christianity more as a social outreach or something that is an attitude or a frame of mind or whatever, forgetting completely that it's about blood that was shed. I mean, that's central to everything. We look at the controversy that was surrounding that movie, The Passion, and everybody was freaking out. Well, it's so gory and it's so bloody. But the fact is, and we can't escape that central to Judeo-Christian understanding of a relationship with God is this idea of blood and of sacrifice. And so God was driving that home In this. And so he's even talking about it. Even when you're out hunting, there's certain ways in which I want you to deal with blood. You know, you kill an animal, you're still going to drain its blood. You're going to cover it up with dust. He talks about roadkill, even, amazingly enough. He's talking about the animals that die naturally or what's torn by beasts. You know, in other words, you know, you find something on the side of the road, it's still good meat. You know, don't let it go to waste. And so, but there are ways in which they're to deal with it, and certain manners in which they're supposed to make sure that it at least has a certain level of ceremonial cleanness. See, God is pointing to the final solution for sin. Why this big deal about blood? It's the final solution for sin. Sin is atoned for by only one means, not our good works, not our efforts to do better, not by anything except what Jesus did on the cross. When he died and he shed his blood, it was his blood, the innocent blood of the God-man, poured out on our behalf that cleansed us from sin. There's no other way we get right. And so, you know, God is putting this attitude of respect, and if the Israelites were to have this kind of respect for a blood of an animal, how much more respect should we be having for the blood of Christ? And that's why Hebrews makes it, you know, such a strong warning about trampling underfoot the blood of Christ, you know, treating it as though it's not an important thing, as though it's something that can be profaned that way. All right, chapter 18 deals with sexual conduct, and it's a little more intense, I guess you would say, and it has a few more controversial subjects involved in it. You know, the thing about it is, I took pain medication, so I can talk about any of this right now. But the thing about it is God made us sexual beings. I mean, sometimes, you know, we get so prudish about this, and I know I'm guilty of this. I get all embarrassed and I blush and all of that. But I mean, the fact is, God's not embarrassed of us. God made us as sexual beings. He made us with this ability and this desire. It's a function that he programmed into us. That's a part of who we are as human beings. But so there's nothing wrong. There is nothing wrong with sexuality in and of itself. When we're talking about humans as sexual creatures, as sexual beings, we're that way. We have these drives. We have these desires. It's fun to us. I mean, that's just the way God made it. But he's also getting across that he doesn't want our sexuality to run amok, that we can't live out of sexuality. And that's what his point is in all of this. Yes, we're sexual creatures. Yes, we have these desires and we have these drives that God placed in us, but we have to be careful how we live with these desires and with these drives. And we can't live out of that, because if we live solely out of that and we let those desires and those aspects of our life take control, then there are problems. And there are problems, especially from God's standpoint, in terms of the boundaries that he sets in place. God clearly identifies boundaries for sexual conduct. And these are things that translate, you know, I realize they're Old Testament codes of conduct, but there are moral principles that carry through to the New Testament. And we find them amplified even in the New Testament, going down to the very heart of the matter, even beyond the actual act itself at times, to the thoughts that a man or a woman will dwell on. And so God's trying to jog the memory of a fallen people. Remember, that's what this is all about. God is coming to this amnesiac race who's fallen from their place of purity with him. God had an original design for all of this. God had a purpose for it. It's a beautiful thing. And what he designed between a man and a woman is a beautiful thing. But it's been so corrupted and abused and twisted and perverted by the fall that God's got to come to mankind now and jog our memory, so to speak, to try to get it across. There's an original intent for this. There's a purpose for this. And it's not just to live out of it, not just to dwell in the desires of that continually. What has happened in this fallen planet has defiled his plan for sex. And so let me just read verses 1-5 real quick here, because it sets the stage. God's explaining. Here's why this is important. He says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I'm the Lord your God. According to the doings of all the land of Egypt where you dwelt, you shall not do. And according to the doings of the land of Canaan, where I'm bringing you, you shall not do, nor shall you walk in their ordinances. In other words, he's saying, there's ways in which they behaved in Egypt concerning sex, and there's ways in which they behave over here in Canaan concerning sex. In other words, popular culture has a view of sex that is not going to be my view of sex, and I want you to understand that. And he says in verse 4, you shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances to walk in them. I'm the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and judgment, which if a man does, what? He shall live by them. I'm the Lord. And so here we see, God's explaining why this is important. Yeah, I'm your God. I don't want you to be like the perverts in the neighborhood. I want you to understand. I'm giving you clear, easy to follow instructions here on how to do this. And if you do this, he's saying, you'll live. You'll understand what life is really all about. You'll understand what it means to live. And that, I'll tell you, nothing could be more important than that. Again, remember, we're looking at Old Testament codes of conduct, but they do translate into New Testament principles of how we're to deal with one another when it comes to sexuality, how men and women are to relate. And the thing about it is our culture is so screwed up when it comes to sex, is so misguided and confused that we don't even know what it is to live. I mean, if you look at this culture has no clue as to what real sexuality is in its purest form and how it can be something that's beautiful and how to actually enjoy life in the midst of that. All our culture knows is the raw animalistic type of sexuality that's presented on MTV and the likes. I mean, it's an old Tibetan proverb, but I'll tell you, it's so true. When it says that when creativity is absent, sexuality emerges. And, you know, that's all you got to do. All you got to do is look at some music videos and realize there's nothing creative there at all. There's nothing happening creatively, musically or anything. There's no art in that. It's just raw sexuality. It's animalistic. We're just going to go out and wangle our bodies around and that'll get somebody's attention and we'll get a few bucks off the deal. But there's no creativity there. There's no beauty in that. And it's not what God's intention was. So he's trying to get this across, that you can live by this. You can live and know what it means to experience life. Verses 6 through 9, he begins outlining one of the, you know, how this is going to be different. This is the way the Egyptians behaved. This is the way the Canaanites are behaving. This is the way popular culture is behaving, you know, around them at that time. And popular culture is going to change depending, you know, on time and generation and all. But verse 6, he says, you shall not approach anyone who is near of kin of you, none of you shall approach anyone who is near of kin to him to uncover his nakedness. I'm the Lord. The nakedness of your father or the nakedness of your mother, you shall not uncover. She's your mother, for crying out loud. You shall not uncover her nakedness. For crying out loud is the parenthetical insertion there by the Woodrum translation. But anyway, the nakedness of your father's wife you shall not uncover. It's your father's nakedness. The nakedness of your sister, the daughter, and on and on and on. And he goes on through there with all these various nakedness verses here. Down through chapter 9. Now, to uncover the nakedness of someone is kind of a broad term. By and large, its main implication is the idea of sexual intimacy, of sexual intercourse. But it's a broader term really than that. It's not just identifying that. It actually can include things that come, you know, right up to the boundaries of sexual intercourse, just short of it. So God is saying here that, and he's talking about in these verses through verse 9, he's talking about incest, and he's saying, you know, this is right out. This is completely out of the question. And you'd think he wouldn't even have to mention something like that. But you know, it seems gross to us, but when sexual morality begins to disintegrate, the boundaries also of what would seem acceptable or what would be okay begin to blur. We begin moving, you know, when a culture begins moving by the philosophy that, well, if it feels good, it must be okay. If it feels good, let's do this. Let's pursue it. Then as that disintegrates, all kinds of boundaries disintegrate. So obviously we're looking at what was taking place within the cultures around the Israelites at that time. And he's saying, look, this is, you know, right off the bat, I got to get something clear with you guys. None of this stuff that they're doing over here. You're not to do this in terms of incest. Those inhibitions begin to blur once those moral boundaries begin to fade away. And so, and notice there in verse 8, what an interesting phrase that he uses there. The nakedness of the father's wife is the father's nakedness. which is an interesting turn of a phrase to me. I think about that. What I mean is it's reinforcing the concept. As I'm trying to, what I mean by what I think about that, I'm thinking about what he means by that. But it's reinforcing the concept of Genesis 2:2. The two shall become one flesh. And therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife. The two shall become one flesh. And again, you realize, you know, you're talking about, you know, the nakedness of his wife is the husband's nakedness, or the father's nakedness rather. And the idea then is that the husband and wife have an intimacy that's far beyond just the sexual interaction of that. It's far deeper than just the physical stimulation of it. There's something deep and mysterious that takes place in this, and that's why it's important to God. That's why it's something that He places such an emphasis about making sure that we live within the certain understanding for what it's for, and live with those boundaries in mind. The act itself is one thing. That's where our culture places its highest priority. That's where, you know, all the pleasures involved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the act itself becomes the thing that's the most important, as opposed to the relationship and the intimacy that is supposed to actually evolve from or come from. Let's see, verses 10 through 18, he basically just gives some more details about different configurations of what amount to incest. So we don't need to bog down in all of that. Verse 19 harkens back to chapter 15 in dealing with the uncleanness during a woman's menstruation. Verse 20, in Exodus 20:14, God prohibits adultery. He said, "You shall not commit adultery." In verse 20, he says here, "Moreover, you shall not lie carnally with your neighbor's wife to defile yourself with her." So here, he's reiterating this with the detail of the act itself, and there's no justification provided for this. No, you know, explanations or justifications or anything like that. This is something that God is just making it very clear. This is prohibited. This is wrong. This is outside of the boundaries for what I intended this to be, and it defiles the beauty of it. It defiles its original intention. Then verse 21. This is kind of curious. Then all of a sudden, he throws this in: "You shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire of Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." And you kind of think, well, you know, okay, he's dealing with sexual conduct and all this, and all of a sudden, just off the cuff, and then he says, "Oh yeah, by the way, and don't, you know, pass through the fire of Molech." What's that all about? Well, in actuality, and it's just an awful thing to realize, and the act of Molech worship entailed taking children and passing them through a heated idol that was heated up with a fire. It would kill the children. And the idea behind it was child sacrifice, infanticide. And they're thinking that one of the main reasons behind it, when you've got temple prostitutes and worship that entails a lot of sexual activity, you're going to have a lot of illegitimate children and unwanted pregnancies. So this was a means by which they could get rid of unwanted pregnancies and get rid of children. So God's cutting that off right at the root. Later on, as God talks about this sort of thing, you know, he speaks, you can hear the passion in God's voice as he's speaking through the prophet, saying, you know, "This thing never even entered my mind. I never commanded you to do this. This would have never even occurred to me. This is horrifying what they would have done." So, you know, he's making it very clear. That's completely out of the question. He wants them to have nothing to do with that. And then we get to the volatile verses here. Verse 22, "You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It's an abomination." So right here, right off the bat, there's no way around this. As we're looking at the Old Testament, you know, we've got to face the facts of what this says. God is condemning homosexuality. There's no way around it. We can't say, well, this is just the Old Testament. You know, the Old Testament condemns this, and so, you know, things are a lot more tolerant in the New Testament. But in Romans chapter 1, verses 24 to 32 reinforce this whole concept. This was not God's design. This is not God's plan. This is not God's intention for sex. And so God is making it very clear. It's an abomination, he says. It's absolutely wrong. And all arguments around this ultimately fail. I mean, everybody who tries to argue around this and go into the language, it always breaks down. I haven't yet heard an argument that is the least bit honest in this. The most honest arguments are those who say, well, we just dismiss that altogether. We just don't believe that, or, you know, we're just going to get rid of it. It doesn't work for us. At least they're being honest and saying, well, it's there, but we don't like it, and so we won't listen to it. Popular culture says to us that this is missing the point, that having this in here is what identifies Christianity or Judeo-Christian values as being so backwards and ignorant, because we don't realize that, you know, people are just born that way. And the argument always is, well, you know, somebody's born that way. This is how I was born. I was made this way. I say that popular culture misses the point, because all men are born into sin. And because we're born as natural sinners, because sin has corrupted the heart of every person that comes into the world, just because a person has a propensity towards a particular sin doesn't justify that sin. A person comes into the world a sinner. We have a sinful nature because of Adam and Eve, because we tumbled out of the garden so long ago. So if a man is born in sin, if mankind comes into this world as sinful to begin with, just because a person has a propensity towards a specific sin doesn't justify the sin, doesn't make it right. A person could say, well, you know, I steal. I love to steal. I've been stealing since I was a little kid. We never use that as an excuse. We never say, well, you know, see, it's genetically encoded in him. He just loves to steal. We got to just give him the space for that. Or lie, or cheat, or whatever the sin may be. Just because a person had a propensity towards it from early on doesn't justify it or make it all right or end up validating it in some way. Everyone is attracted to sin immediately. The Bible says we go astray from birth speaking lies. Just because we're attracted to a specific sin doesn't validate it, make it all right. And we can't say this is who I am, because the point is Jesus came to make us brand new human beings. So where I had a propensity to lie, where I had a propensity to steal, where I had a propensity to not rein in my sexual appetites or desires, I can't say, well, this is who I am. Christ came to make me a brand new human being. So every person who comes into Christ has that potential to become a brand new human being with all of those things restored to what God's original intention and purpose was all about. Some will get upset with this. You know, another complaint you hear all the time is, how can this be wrong? How can people say, you know, how can you as Christians or say that this is wrong? We're talking, you know, what's wrong with love between the same sex? What's wrong with a man loving another man or a woman loving another woman? And I say, boy, do you miss the point, because nothing in here is talking about love. There's absolutely nothing wrong with love between a man and a man and a woman and a woman. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. There's nothing wrong with a man loving another man like David loved Jonathan. What's wrong is wanting to have sex with another man if you're a man, or a woman if you're a woman. The issue is about sex. It's all about sex. Forget about this. Forget about love. You can love all you want. There's no prohibitions against love. But there are boundaries around sex. And, you know, it's not real love if it can't be contained, if it's perverted into something that isn't what God intended it to be to begin with. Hey, the pain meds are really kicking in good. I'm doing good here. The fact is, it's a distortion of God's intended purpose. It's a distortion of what God intended in the beginning. Now, some will go into the language and say, well, see, but it says lie with a man as you would with a woman, saying, in other words, the text is really trying to say is that, you know, a man shouldn't be effeminate when engaged in sex with another man. The fact is that you just got to really stretch to try to pull that out of the text. It's just not there. And it's dishonest to try to do that. Let's just face the facts and get over it. God says it's wrong. Now, to qualify, does that mean that we need to make picket signs and talk about killing gays or doing things like that? Absolutely not. That's just as evil as this condemnation here. Are we to treat people with less than respect? Are there people that we're not supposed to love and people that we are supposed to love? Not at all. as Christians, as those under Christ, we're to love all men. Does that mean that, you know, we won't minister to certain people? Not at all. We'll minister, we'll throw our arms open wide and minister to anyone who wants to hear the word of God. But does that mean we'll condone that sort of behavior? Does that mean we'll validate homosexuality? Absolutely not. God makes it as clear as he can make it. And so we've got to stay with that, but love everyone in the process. We're gonna stay with what the word says, but we're gonna stay with what all the word says. When people develop attitudes of hatred and, you know, I can't believe some of these things that I hear at times and the attitudes that come across and the name calling and all of that, that's not Christ. I don't see Christ doing that at any point, at any time. Christ came into the world. He didn't come to condemn it. The condemnation's here already. It hangs like the sword of Damocles over the whole world. He came to give life and to give hope. And that's our calling, to give life and to give hope. And we can do that without condoning that type of sin. We can do that without validating a sinful choice. And so that's where we have to be on that as Christians. Let's see. I lost my place in here. Verse 23. Well, you know, how interesting is this? It's amazing to me. You shall not mate with any animal or defile yourself with it. Now, isn't it odd that nobody's running off to say, you know, I was born like this? It's in the same breath. It's in the almost the same breath of what God is getting across here. Bestiality comes right next after this other subject of homosexuality. God places it in the same thing, but he also put adultery right before that. So we got to be careful even in our thinking on that. We don't want to start identifying homosexuality as the most evil of all sins. It's a sin, but so is adultery. And so are a lot of things that sometimes we'll kind of wink and, you know, and shrug and say, oh, well, that's no big deal, buddy. We don't worry about it. It's everybody slips up. But when it comes to homosexuality, no, we're going to take him out back and kick his butt or whatever. I mean, it's a double standard, and that's incorrect. Sin is sin. And so we deal with sin as sin. But it's interesting that, you know, right on the heels of dealing with homosexuality, then you've got this subject of bestiality, and no one's clamoring to try to validate that. And no one's willing to say they were born that way. That's just the way that goes. Let's see, verses 24 to 30. Let me just read a couple verses out of there. 24 says, "Don't defile yourselves with any of these things, for by these the nations are defiled, which I'm casting out before you." Verse 25, "For the land is defiled. Therefore, I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants." Verse 29, "For whoever commits any of these abominations, the persons who commit them shall be cut off from among their people." So he's going through, he's talking about why he doesn't want them doing this. These are, you know, important commandments. It's a reason why there was a curse upon the land already. He's talking about, you know, it defiles them. Our culture refuses to acknowledge anything sexually as defiling. I think that's an amazing thing. But our culture adamantly denies the possibility that something sexual could actually defile a person, could be, you know, corrupted in some way. Oh, no, that's just choice, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is that there is a defilement. Like, there's a defilement of everything. Every good and right appetite that the Lord built into us and gave us, every drive that is right and pure, is defiled by sin. It gets corrupted and misconstrued and distorted in its practice and its use. And so, obviously, there's defilement there. And then he says the land is defiled. That means it remains in its fallen state, and it's not used for any kind of redeeming purpose whatsoever. And it stays in this state of fallenness and wickedness. And so God's anger and wrath is still present against it. So the land doesn't even enjoy the blessings of God. That's why Paul later on says, you know, all of creation groans in anticipation for the revelation of the sons of God at the end of the age, when this thing comes to its conclusion and God reveals what his whole purpose was and how he's going to restore all things. You know, the land, the earth didn't do this. The animals didn't do this. The birds, you think about the, you know, you see those, like during the Gulf War, you'd see those animals covered with oil during those oil spills, and it just always grips your heart. It's one of the worst things in the world to have to see, because it's such a vision of the innocence that's been hurt and harmed and tainted by the wickedness of humanity. They didn't ask for that war to happen there. It happened, and they end up having to pay this terrible price. And all of creation pays this terrible price for sin, and they groan in anticipation of God delivering them. And so that's what he's even saying to the Israelites there. The land is still corrupted because of them, and the results of it are being cut off from God. You see, God's purpose is to draw us in. God, all the time, throughout all of our history, everyone sitting in this room, God's purpose has been to draw in and to draw you close to him, to bring you back to what you were designed for, to bring you into his presence and to restore you as his child and to establish you in your identity in that. But when we go off and live out of abandonment to sexuality, when we leave off the godly creativity and we're left only with sensuality, then we are cut off from God. Not that God is casting us away, but there's that terrible gulf when we're living out of the flesh and we're not moving by the Spirit. That gulf that seems to separate us and we can't seem to move in harmony or live in harmony with who he is. So God is saying in this, live by this. Come into the understanding of what this was designed for, the beauty of it, the real beauty behind it, and live from those principles. Otherwise, you have this sense of being cut off and distant from him. Well, you know what? It's 8 o'clock. I was going to go on for a couple more chapters, but obviously I'm way too long-winded. So we'll pick up there next time and finish up here pretty soon in Leviticus. So, Father, we just thank you for your word, and we thank you that you've provided it to us so that we can learn from you. And, Lord, in all of these things, I pray that as we go over the Old Testament, that we can see the pictures in it. We can see the beauty of your plan in it. I pray for us even tonight that we don't come under condemnation of the Old Covenant. That's not our purpose, and that was never your purpose in having us study it. But that we see that your plan is there and that you have a purpose and a future for us and a hope. And it's found in Jesus Christ. And so as we live in our relationship with Jesus, help us to walk in such a way that we're in harmony with who you are, that we're in harmony with your original intention for creation. And I pray that for each one of us tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.